Well, you know, I have to admit, I have major faults. Now, I know some of you are like, well, we've known that. I mean, Kurt, we talk about it all the time, and we could list them out. Some of you could tell me all the faults that I have, but I'm going to tell you what, there's one of them that is really going to bother you this morning, unless you're someone who tends to do the same thing that I do. And so, you know, here's one of the deals. I'm a chronic multitasker. I don't know if you multitask. I believe that I can get way more done if I'm doing multiple things at the same time. I believe I'm more efficient when I multitask. I think God loves those more who are more efficient. At least that's what I think. And so I multitask all the time. And there are a number of examples of ways that maybe you do this. I mean, you might chew gum and walk at the same time. Some of you I've seen do that. Some of you have a hard time with that still. Others of you might listen to music and work out at the same time. You multitask while you work out. There are other places in life where it is not healthy. It is actually bad, and things you really shouldn't do. Things like texting and driving, right? I mean, that's something you really shouldn't do. Here's the deal. I do that, all right? I do that. I told you you're going to hate me. I told you you wouldn't like certain things about my life, and this is something I struggle with. Now, I've really refrained since the law went into effect a number of months ago, all right? So the other day, I was sitting at a traffic light, and I was actually dictating into my phone to one of my neighbors. Hey, I see you driving by me in front of me. And they're like, hey, are you texting and driving? No, I'm just sitting and texting while I'm in the road. And I'm using dictation along the way, which I guess is still texting and driving. But, you know, here's the deal. We have family in the state of Ohio. We're over there periodically. The moment I cross the state line, they don't have laws on this. I'm like right back at it. I know how bad it is. I know it's stupid. It is stupid. In fact, I don't need emails today telling me all the ills of texting and driving. I see the same commercials you see, all right? But it's like I'm on crack or something. It's like I can't break the habit. As soon as I know I'm in a place where I can do it again, I'm texting. And it's like I can't stop. And so there are certain things that we can multitask on. There are other things, maybe including texting, that, you know, when we multitask on this deal, it has some pretty harmful or potentially harmful consequences. And so today, as we look at this idea, this second take of accommodating Jesus, this whole idea of how God bends his life toward where we are, you know, for many of us, we struggle with this. For many of us, we struggle with this idea of God actually accommodating me. We think God is some distant God who doesn't really care about what's going on down here on earth, about this distant God who is oblivious to the pain I'm in right now. And it's just kind of carrying out his things regardless of what kind of pain it creates in our lives. And some of that comes from us saying, God, I wish you'd show up more. I wish you'd do exactly what I want. And we almost get this mentality that God is holding out on us. And when we begin to think this way, it's like there's an entitlement perspective that we're coming from. That we believe, God, if you don't do what I say or what I say I need right now, then I don't know that you really care about this. You know, as we just saw in this scene from Modern Family, you know, we find ourselves relationally in this situation all the time. Things going on around us. We actually need help. We actually need to be accommodated. In fact, look at the definition of accommodate. The actual definition is to fit in with the wishes or needs of. I mean, that's what Claire's family was doing right there. She needed to hone some things in her life right there. They're just helping her out. And yet she's totally oblivious to the help, to the accommodating nature that her family's providing right there. And here's what I've discovered. What I've discovered is you can't be looking for more to come your way. You can't be looking for God to show up more and more in all the clearly defined ways that you dictate that God needs to show up in your life and be grateful for what he's already doing in your life at the same time. I mean, you cannot always be looking for more and be very content or have a heart of gratitude with what God's already doing at the same time. It's impossible to multitask on these two. And this is a really, really big issue. In fact, this impacts us relationally. I mean, in our relationships, in our marriages, it impacts us. If we're always looking for more and saying, well, if you do this, if you do that, it's hard to really be thankful for the person that I'm with. And this is true in our relationship with God as well. And so here's some interesting statistics. A number of months ago, I came across these. There were 20,000 people surveyed in a survey, and they were basically asked one question to start. Are you unhappy or happy in your marriage? And based on that question, then they continued the survey. And so 20,000 people identifying, self-reflecting on whether they're happy or unhappy in their marriages. And so of those who said they're unhappy in their marriage, they asked another question. They said, if you're unhappy in your marriage, why are you unhappy? What would you put your finger on as the main theme or the main reason that you're unhappy? And you know what the dominant through line in this survey was? People said, we have irreconcilable differences. You You've probably heard that phrase before, right? A lot of divorces happen for irreconcilable differences. They said, this is fascinating. Let's take it a step further. So they said, well, how many irreconcilable differences do you have? I mean, if you're unhappily married, let's just get an average here. Like, on average, how many irreconcilable differences are there among these thousands of people? You know, any idea how many there were in a typical unhappy marriage? Three. Yeah. Let's do this. How about 11 or 12? 11 to 12 was the average in people who were unhappy. So this created some curiosity for me. I said, well, this is interesting. Let's look at happy marriages. Let's look at how many irreconcilable differences there might be in people who self-identify that they're happy in their marriage relationship. Right? Because it's going to be better, right? So what would you suspect would be the self-identified number of irreconcilable differences in a happy marriage? Three, maybe five, seven. This is what's interesting. 11 or 12. Same numbers. And this said something right here. This was fascinating because, you know, what this tells me is this is not about the differences. This is less about the differences we may have in our relationships and more about how you respond. Do I respond in my relationships, in my marriage, from an entitlement perspective, from a perspective that says, man, these things need to be fixed. And if they're not fixed exactly to the way I self-define what they need to look like, then, man, I'm out. You know, that's an entitlement perspective. Or is my priority in my marriage to say, hey, my main role is to serve my spouse. And yeah, we may have some differences, but if I approach my role as one of serving, then we realize that maybe it looks a little different for us. You know, about this time, this survey came out, Julie and I actually went to her and I said, so, you know, let's talk about the irreconcilable differences we have. It's a fun conversation most of the time. And so, you know, we started dialoguing and came up with a number. I mean, I don't know that we were quite 11 or 12, but we came up with quite a few. I'm going to share three of them with you. The first one that we came up with, we have a very different idea of what it means to be on time for something, anything. I mean, you know, say we need to be in an event at 6:30 in the evening. You know, my idea of being on time is showing up at 6:20, maybe 6:25, depending on the event. Do we need to get in and find a seat in an auditorium, or are we just showing up for dinner with friends at a restaurant? You know, her idea is like showing up at like 6:30-ish, you know, like maybe like 6:40, 6:45. And this is an irreconcilable difference. Let me tell you, after 16 years of marriage, we've been together 20 years, married for 16. We are no closer on this than we were the day we married. The only difference is if you have appointments with me, you realize that she has influenced me more than I have with her, and I'm late all the time. And so, you know, it's an irreconcilable difference. Another one we came up with is we have an irreconcilable difference on proper table etiquette. All right, so, you know, and I think this is a bit nitpicky, if I can really be honest with you. And it's like, we're only about 30 minutes into service. She may not even be in here yet, so I can say that. And so, you know, here's the deal. She thinks that when we eat, she should not hear me chew, right? Before we had kids, man, that was hard. I mean, it was like every, you know, all the time. You know, and you know, after 16 years of marriage, man, the verdict is still out. There are mixed results on this. Four kids later, she believes the kids have better table etiquette than I do. I mean, it's one of those things where we are still at an irreconcilable place on this. The third major one came down to what it means to watch the kids, all right? And so this one really came to a head for us when Matt and Mace were like 2 and 4. And Julie was job sharing at the time, which meant she worked part of the week, was home part of the week. And she had to go into work on a day we didn't have childcare set up because she was typically home. She said to me, Kurt, you know, do you think you could watch the kids that day? Which, you know, for her meant, could you take the day off? Could you work at home? And I said, absolutely, I can watch. I'll take care of the kids that day. You know, even the phrasing was a little bit different. And so, you know, for her, that meant, like, I'm going to be physically present with them. Like, I'm going to be in the same room as them. I'm going to be overseeing what they're doing. My idea of watching the kids was making sure they're cared for. And so, you know, I sent them off to the babysitter. And, you know, they were with her all day as I went down to the racetrack for the afternoon. And she was like, well, you know, when she had to pick them up at the center, she said, I thought you were watching the kids. I'm like, I took care of them, right? I mean, we're still at a point. You know, it's two different understandings of what that means. Now, here's the deal. Here's what's interesting. You know, these are just differences, right? These aren't irreconcilable. They're just differences. And we can laugh about it. I can talk about it today because it's how we respond to the differences. You know, do I feel entitled that she has to see everything exactly the way I do? You know, does she feel like I have to see everything and do everything exactly the way she wants? Or if so, then our relationship is based on entitlement. You know, if you don't do this, and if you don't continue to adjust to me, then and do everything that I expect of you, that's a position of entitlement. And so today, as we look at another story, another picture from the Old Testament of how God bends his life toward us, how he bends his presence toward us to accommodate us, to provide, to connect with us, you know, I want us to really kind of see what this might look like for our lives. You know, for years, hundreds, thousands of years, God has been assembling teams of people together with very unique purposes. And one of the early teams that God puts together, we find in Genesis chapter 12, and it's called the Nation of Israel. And so in Genesis 12, God goes to a guy by the name of Abram. Later, his name becomes Abraham. And he says to him, he says, you know, Abram, in fact, here's what he says in verse chapter 12. I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. And so what God's really saying, he's saying, hey, you are going to create a lineage of people. There are going to be more people in your lineage than there are grains of sand on the beach. And you're going to be a blessing to people. When people come in contact with you, they're going to be better off for it. When people experience you in the community and grow up around this new nation I'm creating, they're going to be like, man, if Israel ever leaves, we're screwed. And so, you know, it's this idea, you're there to be a blessing. And so Abram's like, hey, this is a great idea. I want to be a part of this. Here's the problem, God. My wife and I, we're barren. And he started like laughing this thing off. He's like, I'm like 100 years old. He's like, we haven't been able to have kids. You're telling me at 100 years old, we're going to begin to have children. I'm 100, she's 90. Come on, do the math. This doesn't work at this point. And yet, God begins to fulfill this promise. And so you see what's happening right here. It's with the coming of Abraham, God is beginning to set a new plan in motion for the entire planet. You see, up to this point, every time humanity began to tank, God just wiped the earth clean. He did that a couple times already. And it's not working. So he says, I'm going to do it different this time. I'm going to start with a pioneer settlement, and I'm going to begin to create a love relationship with this group of people to show you what it looks like to be connected, what it looks like to be in relationship with me. And so he says something to Abraham. A few chapters later, he says, Abraham, here's what I want you to do. I want you to go. That's pretty much it. I want you to go. And then he says, to a place I'm going to show you later. Now, Abraham was pretty content where he was. I mean, he's pretty stable, had a good income, good family life, well provided for in the fields as he was watching over sheep, as he was living with his family. And he had no reason to leave what he was currently doing, with the exception of God comes to him and says, hey, I want you to go and go to this place that I'm not even going to tell you about yet. And so this is what Abraham does. And it's interesting because more than any other person we see, at least in the Old Testament, Abraham characterizes faith. And he's this pillar of faith. And I think one of the reasons that is because he makes himself available to God. He makes himself available to be used by God. And out of that, a nation is born, which becomes the model for God's love relationship with his people. And yet what God asks Abraham to do next takes this deal to a whole new place. But here's what it says in a couple chapters later. Sometime later, God tested Abraham. He said to him, Abraham... Abraham said, here I am, he replied. So you see, Abraham began to get used to what God's voice sounded like because he was in tune with God. Then God said, take your son, your only son whom you love, Isaac, and go to the region of Moriah. Now you see, Abraham and Sarah began to have children. And Abraham, Isaac wasn't actually his only son, but it was his first son. And there was something about the firstborn that made him very significant. He was to receive the lion's share inheritance of you know, everything that his father and family owned. And so he says, take your son and sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on a mountain. I will show you. Now, some readers have understandable objections with this right here. I mean, especially as it's often interpreted. I mean, this idea, well, you're asking me to sacrifice my son? I mean, human sacrifice, infant sacrifice? You know, some people have interpreted this passage to mean that God has called Abraham to murder his son and to just do whatever God, you know, hey, God, you tell me to do this, I'm going to go do it, oblivious to what that actually means. I mean, fly an airplane into a building, sure, if that's what you want me to do. I mean, we misinterpret it, what it really means to be faithful and submissive to God. And a lot of times this passage is used. And whenever we do that, we're really kind of oblivious, or we're missing this idea of what was going on in Jewish thought and in Jewish customs, in Jewish symbolism of that day. We see God over and over and over again was telling his people of that day, telling the Hebrew nation, hey, your firstborn son, you're going to have to forfeit your firstborn son. There's kind of this universal sinfulness that everyone's aware of. We're fallen, we're broken, there's this universal nature. There's going to have to be a debt that's called in for your sin, and it's going to be in the form of your firstborn son. So this wasn't as unique to Abraham as it is to you and I when we hear this. I mean, a lot of the other religions, all the other polytheistic, monolithic religions where they're worshiping multiple gods had the same thing. And so it wasn't a real far stretch for people to hear this in that culture. But what Abraham understood was that for this is a son he loved, his firstborn child. And he understood that there was every family on earth owes this. There's got to be eternal justice that happens. And my debt's going to be called in because I'm sinful. Of this universal nature of sinfulness. And so God's not calling Abraham to murder his son. What he's doing is he's calling in Abraham's death. And it's not hard to see the repeat nature of what God does here. How God continues to call him. He keeps saying, to this place I'm going to show you. I want you to go, Abraham, and I'm going to reveal to you what you're going to do once you get there. I want you to go and leave your security. Leave everything that brings stability to your life. Everything your heart is rested in. And now he's saying, Abraham, I want you to give up your heart's desire. I mean, his son Isaac was like the thing he'd always longed for. He said, I want you to make him an offering to God. And this is what's going on right here. You see, it's interesting. It's hard when we feel entitled. I mean, Abraham's probably thinking, man, what are you talking about, God? I mean, what are you talking about? I mean, you said I'm going to be a great nation. I'm going to have this incredible lineage, and you're taking my firstborn son? And so I want us to look at what happened with Abraham, how Abraham responded right here. There's three ways that Abraham responded in this situation that allow us to overcome this sense of entitlement, this sense of being very keenly aware of how God is actually bending and accommodating me at nearly every moment. And so the first is this. First thing we see in the story of Abraham is Abraham is thankful. He has a heart of gratitude when things could be better. All right, think about this. In this story, things could be better, right? I mean, Abraham's like, hey, God gave me this great promise. I'm going to create a great lineage. There's this minor problem. He says that my firstborn son is going to have to be sacrificed. He's like, man, that's kind of a small problem if I'm going to fulfill this thing God has asked me to do. What's up with that, God? You see, for many of us, we have a hard time being grateful when we're in a position where we think, man, things could actually be better. We have a hard time finding gratitude right there. I mean, it's hard to be thankful for the person you're dating when you see maybe your girlfriend's boyfriend. You're like, oh, man, he's a lot better than mine. It's hard to be thankful when you think other people have something better than you. I mean, when you look at somebody else's kids, you're like, man, their kids are way better than mine. It's hard to have a heart of gratitude for your kids. I mean, it's hard when you look at everybody else's job and you're like, man, if I had their job, I'd be in such a better place. It's hard to be thankful for your job when you're always wishing you had someone else's. You see, we play this comparison entitlement game, and we're always multitasking. We're like, God, I wish I had more. When is more going to be coming my way? And it's hard in those moments to actually have a heart of gratitude. And so Abraham right here, he has a heart of gratitude. Is an attitude of gratitude, even when things aren't going well. Take a look how the story continues. It says, early the next morning, Abraham got up and he loaded his donkey. He took with him two of his servants and his son Isaac. When he had cut enough wood for the burnt offering, he set out for the place God had told him about. So let's be clear what God is doing right here. Let's be clear what Abraham's doing right here. God's saying, Abraham, you're going to go on this journey and I'm calling in your debt. You're going to have to sacrifice your oldest son. And not only is he asking him to do this, but get this, he's asking him to do the grunt labor. I mean, he's asking him to pick up the axe and to carry the wood. And with every time he hits the wood, with every swing of the axe, he begins to realize that I'm one step closer to that debt being called in. I wasn't really thinking about that when I did that. Either. With every swing, he's like, this is one step closer. God, I'm not really sure. And here I am doing the hard work, preparing this altar. And I know in some way you said you're going to provide, but I'm not seeing it right now. And we saw a great example of this last week. I don't know where you were when you heard the news of Peyton Manning leaving Indianapolis. I can tell you exactly where I was. I was, you know, football fan or not, I think it probably had to touch every single one of us. Driving down 116th Street was where I was. I actually got a text on my phone that, you know, Peyton Manning's leaving the Colts, because I always look at my phone when I'm driving, apparently. And I turned on my radio, started listening to the press conference, got in a couple minutes late. And, 2 minutes later, by the time I get, like, to Cumberland Road, I'm, like, bawling in the car. All right, man, I got like tears running down my face. And I'm like, why? Why am I crying? I mean, you know, football will go on. It's not going to be nearly as good for the next few years. But I realized quickly, it's not about just, you know, that I've loved the last at least 10 years. I don't know about the last 14. But I mean, the ride the Colts have been on has been fantastic. But it's the humility of this guy. I mean, it's listening to this guy talk about all of his teammates, all the way down to like the equipment people and how great all of those people have made his experience here in Indianapolis. And you talk about a person that could have a little bit of entitlement. I mean, you talk about somebody that could say, hey, man, I've had a rough year. I had some physical things I couldn't help. And it's kind of a difficult time. And man, you guys should be grateful for all that I've done. There should be more coming my way. And what is he doing? He's talking about how thankful he is for all that he's experienced. I mean, the guy has literally changed this town from a basketball town into a football town. I mean, he's built buildings on his back, right? I mean, like Peyton Manning's Children's Hospital. We're a recipient of that. I mean, one of our kids spent some time up there. Lucas Oil Stadium, people say, I mean, that was built on Peyton's shoulders, on the success that he provided for the city. And then he gets to the end of his press conference, and he says this phrase. He says, okay, now I want to say something to the fans. And I'm like, all right, here it goes. Here's where he's going to stick the knife in and twist it a little bit. And, you know, he's probably going to say something right here, like it's been a great ride, but I didn't get what I want, so I'm out of here. But he didn't say that, did he? He said, hey, I want to say something to the fans. And I thought maybe he's going to say something like, hey, you know, I didn't get what I want. You know, you're probably going to have a season just like you had last year. Good luck. No pun intended. Good luck. You'll get that later. But he didn't say it. You know what he said? If you didn't hear it, here's what he said. He said, I want to say something to the fans, the Colts fans everywhere. He said, thank you very much from the bottom of my heart. I have truly enjoyed being your quarterback. He said, I don't know where I'm going. I don't know what the next step is. I haven't really thought about that. But what I have thought about is everything I've experienced. I mean, I am grateful. Talk about a guy that had every right to be entitled. At a time when, man, things definitely could be better. Let's move on. Story goes on. It says, on the third day, Abraham looked up and he saw the place in the distance. He said to his servant, stay here with the donkey while I go. I and the boy go over there. We will worship. Now, I want to stop right here. We will worship. What are you talking about? We're going to worship? I mean, you worship God when things are great, right? You think you worship God when you're thankful. You go to church and you connect with God when everything in your life is going exactly the way you want it to. I mean, you worship God. You thank God for how great he is when he's doing everything that you've been asking for. And he's sending you more and more. What are you doing preparing an altar? Abraham, you're getting ready to continue on with this sacrifice of your son because your debt's being called in. And you're saying, we're going to go over here and worship? He says, we will worship and then we will come back to you. Now, this is an interesting statement right here. Because it's like this is the hope he's hanging on to. He's saying, hey, we, not I will come back to you, we. He's like, hey, I don't know how this is going to work out. When we go up to this altar and I build this thing, I don't know how it's all going to go down. But I can't do this, but somehow I serve a God, and somehow God is going to work this out. And my son and I, we're coming back. You see, Abraham had his eyes fixed on the provision. He was very aware of how God was had continued to provide for his needs. So not only was he thankful when things could be better, but it gets worse. He was thankful when things were bad. When things were bad. I mean, let's be honest. You got to think, he's like, come on, God. I mean, I'm waiting. I don't know how this is all going to work out. And at one point, Isaac comes up to him, and Isaac is actually carrying the wood for the altar. And Abraham has the knife or the axe in his hands along with the fire. And Isaac's like 7 or 8 at the time. And he comes up to his dad. He's like, Dad, you know, we've got the wood and we've got the knife and we've got the fire. But Dad, where's the sacrifice? And you got to think, he just looked into his son's eyes and saw the sacrifice in front of him. At least that's all he could see at that moment. I mean, I thought today about bringing my 7-year-old son up with me to just sit here while I taught today, to just really bring the connection of a father-son and what this may have been like, and you know, that to say these words, I thought, man, that'll screw him up for life if he were to hear me say that. Right? And I wasn't like going to be lifting the axe or anything. Think about this. I mean, I don't know what happened. I don't know if God protected Isaac. I don't know what took place. But God is calling in. I mean, you have to think Abraham was getting down very methodically. You know, just slowly building the altar. I mean, slowly moving the wood, thinking, man, if I just take my time, maybe in some way I'm giving God a little more time to come through. You know, and he gets to the point where there's nothing left to do except to begin to bind up the sacrifice. And so that's what he does. He begins to bind up his son. The 7, 8, 9-year-old son, he begins to bind him. So we see Abraham's thankful when things could be better. He's thankful when things are bad. And here's where it gets good. We see Abraham's thankful when things are going good. I mean, all of a sudden, take a look at what happens next. But the angel of the Lord called out from heaven, Abraham, Abraham. See, he recognized the voice of God. Isn't it important to recognize the voice of God in moments like this? Here I am. He replied, do not lay a hand on the boy, he said. Do not do anything to him. Now I know that you fear God because you have not withheld from me your son, your only son. Abraham looked up, and there in the thicket he saw a ram caught by its horns. God accommodated. In that moment, God provided. God came through. And what's fascinating is Abraham wasn't saying, God, what in the world? I mean, I had my son on the altar, and if it weren't for my keen eyesight, if it weren't for me just kind of looking out to the distance and actually noticing this ram that got caught up, you know, Abraham took no credit for this. In fact, what was their response? Son, here is the sacrifice. It's right here. Look, a ram, the sacrifice. Let's put it on the altar. We're going to worship you. And an attitude of gratitude when things got better. You know, I don't know what it's like to sacrifice a son. I've never had to do that, fortunately. Probably never will have to, thank God. But you know, I know that there's been certain times throughout my life that whenever God calls, and for me that's been times when God's called me to move ministry positions. God's kind of said, hey, you're done here, and it's time to go to a new place. And a lot of times when God begins to stir and Julie and I, it's time to go, you know, God doesn't show you where you're going. He just says, go, I need you to trust. And I think that for the most part, Julie and I have been pretty faithful, unless there's something I've missed over the years. And yet, to be honest with you, the last time God said, hey, he started stirring, saying, Kurt, it's time to go. It's time to begin to get prepared to go to the next land that I'm going to show you. It was a lot more difficult for us. And I realized why. It was because we had two kids at the time. They were 2 and 4 at the time, our oldest two. And you know, there's an increasing weight that you have when you begin to consider just going and following God in a time when it's not just affecting you any longer, but it has residual impact on the rest of you. I mean, it was easier when it was just Julie and I. Hey, we can make it. You know, I mean, we had questions like, hey, you know, I remember thinking, you know, I think I'm entitled to a paycheck. I think I'm entitled to knowing that there's money in a bank that's gonna help me live for, you know, the next month. I think I'm entitled to some stability. I remember having a conversation with God and just saying to God, God, you know, come on, this is way too risky. I mean, starting something that's not there, going to a new community and knowing all of the ways that our family could be torn down. I love my kids too much. I love my wife too much. I'm entitled to a good life, God. I mean, I'm laying myself out for you right here. And yet, I'll never forget a conversation Julie and I had one night. I mean, our best conversations come late at night. And she looked up and she said, Kurt, you know, what do you think it would say to and show our kids for us to not obey God? And I thought of this story. I thought, you know, what would it have said to Isaac? I mean, yeah, I don't know what was going on in his head and if he had any, you know, counseling appointments for the rest of his life. I don't know. But what would it have said to Isaac if Abraham would not have been faithful in walking down the path that God was calling him? I think so many times we get in this entitlement perspective. We're like, man, God, when are you going to come through? And yet God's providing the ram right there. We're just not seeing it. And for some of us, we may be struggling financially. Saying, God, I mean, when are you going to give me a job that pays more? And we're missing that God continues to take care of you. I mean, Julie and I have been on a path to financial freedom for the last 3 years. And there's been times when I'm like, God, you know, it'd be nice if a windfall came our way and we could take care of this. And yet when I'm always looking for more, I miss how God has continued to allow us to live even below our means so that we could pay off our debt. And I'm just left with this attitude, oh my word, God, you just keep providing. Just keep providing. I mean, times when we feel like, man, when are you going to give me a better job? And yet maybe when we're always focused on what the next thing is and God, when is more going to come, we miss how God is actually providing what we need right now. Maybe the ram's right there and we're just not seeing it. You're going to sing this song that talks about God, you know, let me feel you shine. And I'm just going to ask us to kind of open up and maybe allow God to reveal to us as we sing this. Maybe those places in our lives where God is already providing. Maybe you're here for the first time. You've not been in church in a while or ever. And you've always thought of God as some distant God. And a God who doesn't really bend. I mean, you've got to bend your life to Him totally. You know, there's kind of a mutual bending when we come in a relationship with God. But maybe you're getting a picture of a God who will do anything possible to bend to where you are, to accommodate you, to love you, to provide a pathway so that you can experience Him. Maybe for the first time, you say, man, God, I need that kind of God. I need to know there's a God who will meet me where I am, who's already given me a covering for all of my sinfulness, all of my brokenness, and will begin to restore. So let's stand, and we're going to sing. And I just ask you to just be open. Whatever God might want to do, I don't know where this falls for you, but God meets us where we are. Allow Him to begin to show you maybe where the ram is already in your